Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Tad Tobey. I'm a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Directors. I'm president of the Crit Foundation, chairman of Tobey Philanthropies, and I'm honored to be your chair for tonight's program. That program is part of the club's Tobey American Values series, underwritten by the Tobey Family Foundation. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, David Davenport, Director for External Relations and Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. Before his involvement with the Hoover, David Davenport served as president of Pepperdine University from 1985 to the year 2000. Under his leadership at Pepperdine, the university experienced significant growth in quality and reputation. Mr. Davenport co-chairs Common Sense California, which is a bipartisan effort to engage citizens and bring their pragmatic solutions to some of the state's most pressing problems. He also was a member of Governor Schwarzenegger's California Performance Review Commission. Mr. Davenport is a member of three corporate boards, Ameron International, Forest Lawn, and Salem Communications. His work on policy is included in regular radio commentaries on the Salem Radio Network and townhall.com, as well as in frequent newspaper columns in the San Francisco Chronicle and other periodicals. Mr. Davenport has contributed chapters to Hoover Books on Values and a Free Society and Legal Threats to American Values. He has also authored articles in Policy Review, The New Diplomacy, and The Politics of Literacy. David Davenport earned a BA with distinction in international relations from Stanford University and a JD from the University of Kansas School of Law, where he was elected to the Order of the Coif and earned national and international awards in moot court competitions. Mr. Davenport's speech this evening is titled, quote, "A Republic If You Can Keep It." From many different quarters today come challenges to make America, quote, fair, unquote, or a more democratic place. Recent books suggesting from a new constitutional convention to update our founding document up to challenges to the Electoral College and many, many other suggestions to reform our government. Taken together, however, these challenge the founders' ideal of America as a republic, not a national democracy. Is a republic still viable or useful today? And if so, how can we retain it? Please give us a warm Commonwealth Club welcome for David Davenport.
Thank you very much, Tad. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to be with you in San Francisco and at the Commonwealth Club this evening. I don't want to undermine Tad's very generous introduction, but the central fact, I think, of my professional biography is that I've spent something like 35 of the last 40 years on college campuses in one capacity or another. And so what I've worked with day-to-day for many, many years are college students. And I thought I'd begin tonight on a lighter note for just a moment and share with you, if you think it's easy working with college students, I'm going to share with you some essays and paper, excerpts from student papers, in a collection of these from an English and history professor. He has gone through student essays, blue books, and captured some of his favorite quotations from university students, not from Stanford, of course, or Pepperdine. And in this case, this particular volume, he has excerpted some essays about history. History, this student writes, a record of things left behind by past generations, started in 1815. Thus, we should try to view historical times as the behind of the present. This student writes, from secondary sources, we are given hindsight into the future. Hindsight, after all, is caused by lack of foresight. I think there's probably some truth to that one. This student is writing about a specific time in history and writes as follows. The scientific revolution developed a suppository of knowledge, which greatly helped later generations. Copernicus showed that the solar system rotates around the Earth. Galileo was condemned for following the Copernican theory and was forced by the church to study mechanics for the rest of his life. So that summarizes a great deal you might have missed in history. Moving forward to the Cold War period, this student writes, the USSR and USA became global in power, but Europe remained incontinent. I thought about when President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld were having some of their problems with the old and new Europe. I thought about sharing that with them, but I was afraid they would use it, so I didn't pass it along. And I'll close with this one. This student very practically writes, actually, the fall of empires, he says, has been a good thing because it gives more people a chance to exploit their own people without outside interference. So that's... Well, that said, one of the aspects of scholarly work which I enjoy is looking at what might seem to be unrelated events or data points, in my case on the political scene or the legal policy scene, and see where there might be some kind of connection. One might call this the Yogi Berra school of scholarship. The great philosopher Yogi Berra said, you can do a lot of observing just by watching. And so I'm going to share with you tonight some observations that I've made in three or four different political scenes, though I could have chosen some others, and I'll mention a few of those briefly at the end. And it seems to me that these observations I see in different political settings should prompt us to ask again a very important question raised by Benjamin Franklin over 200 years ago. You'll probably recall the story about Franklin, remembering that much of the process of drafting and negotiating the Constitution took place not only behind closed doors, but frankly even closed curtains. So there was a great deal of curiosity about what the founders were doing there. And the story goes, as Franklin comes out of Independence Hall, he's stopped on the steps by a woman who asks, what kind of government have you given us, Dr. Franklin? And his answer, I think, is an important one for us to consider tonight. He said, a republic, if you can keep it. And, of course, in that day, the main alternative to a republic would have been a monarchy. But the question I want to ask tonight is whether the republic faces some significant danger from a very different source, and that is from a national democracy. I see in several different settings pressure toward what I would could only describe as a national democracy, each of which may not be as problematic in and of itself, but I think added up creates an undermining effect on the idea of republic. And so I want to examine that and see whether we think it is important to continue to keep a republic, what challenges we may face in that regard, and how we might go about it. So let me take you to these, say, three scenes in which I see some of these dangers. We can start right here in California, where, of course, we seem to lurch from crisis to crisis in governance, but where we really pioneer is in the use of direct democracy. Ballot propositions, recalls, referenda, and the like. And, of course, these measures were originally intended to be used by the people in cases of political emergency, where they were so unhappy with a direction that their leadership was or was not taking that the people held some power in reserve, if you will, and could intervene if necessary using some of these fairly extraordinary tools. But the reality in California, I think, is that now ballot propositions have become a primary, and I think you could even argue the primary way of doing business if you want to make a major change in California policy. For example, in the election we just had in November, we had a dozen statewide propositions where you and I were asked as citizens and voters to make important decisions on everything from how calves who are raised for veal, egg-laying hens and pregnant pigs can be legally confined. That was one of the questions we had to answer. Whether the state budget should be further earmarked for police and for prisons. all the way to state policy on renewable energy and same-sex marriage. And don't forget the $12 billion we were asked to decide on with regard to trains and other bond issues that were on this ballot. Well, why is all of that a problem for the Republic? Because part of the essence of a Republic is that we would have elected representatives who would deliberate and decide policy, not people directly voting and deciding policy themselves. And why is that important? Well, representatives can do things, presumably, that the people cannot do directly. Representatives can hold hearings. They can debate and modify and amend language. They can deliberate and discuss. But you and I are asked to read a ballot book, which, according to the research, very few of us actually do, and then go into a booth and spend a few minutes and make all kinds of these billion-dollar decisions that affect the future of our state. And I just think we have to face the fact that right here in our own home state, these mechanisms, these ballot propositions, even recall and so forth that I'll discuss in a moment, these aren't just safeguards for the people anymore. It has become a primary way of doing business in California and elsewhere. We have had over 300 of these, which I would describe as largely end runs around the legislative process in the last 25 or so years. About two-thirds of the state budget is locked up in decisions that we have made at ballots or by federal budgetary mandates. And so it causes me to observe, no wonder experienced legislators can't operate on our budget deficit problems wearing these kind of handcuffs, except we don't really have a lot of experienced legislators anymore because another tool of direct democracy, term limits, has removed most of our experienced legislators. Now, if we don't like what a governor is doing, we can't wait for his term to address that. We don't have that much patience. So we go out and gather 900,000 signatures, which turned out to be, as the law requires, 12% of those who voted in the last election, out of 22 million people at the time of voting age. And we recall the governor, even if we just elected him by a wide margin only months earlier, and nothing much, in my view, had really changed. Patience, moderation, deliberation have all given way to what we might call, quoting another Bay Area leader, Al Davis, just win, baby, politics. Nobody seems to really care so much about the process. They care about winning on their particular issue. So I just suggest to you, for starters, that one of the winds blowing against the Republic is this tool of direct democracy. And I think with technology and the internet making it possible for special interests to mobilize even more rapidly, this is not going to go away anytime soon. A second area in which I see pressures against the idea of republic is unleashing the tool of fairness or more democracy. When I come to this point, I realize I'm sort of fighting against some political winds. When my children were young, they enjoyed a series of books about the Berenstain Bears. And one in particular they thought was just so ridiculous, titled Too Much Birthday. And the notion that you could possibly have too much birthday when you were a kid was just sort of impossible for them to get around. And so I sort of picture myself writing this Berenstain Bears book, Too Much Democracy. And I know on its face how ridiculous it sounds, but if you'll just give me a moment. One example, I think, was in the news just last week. Last week, the Electoral College confirmed the election of Barack Obama. By the way, as an aside, does anyone know where the Electoral College met last week? Most people don't. I had a quiz in the San Francisco Chronicle last year in which I asked a number of questions like this. You know, where does the Electoral College meet? And I gave various choices, and how often does it meet? The Electoral College doesn't meet. And there is in the Constitution no reference to any such thing as an electoral college. If you want to have a nice trivia question at the ready, the Constitution refers to electors, not a college of electors, and the electors meet in the states where they were chosen, and then they communicate their information to Congress from their home state. So no electoral college actually met. Various electors met in individual states and then communicated their decision last week. But on the same day and at the same moment, actually, Senator Bill Nelson of Florida also put in the hopper a proposed constitutional amendment in Washington to eliminate the Electoral College, saying that it is outdated and that it is unfair. He might as well have gone on and said undemocratic, because that's another charge that's often made against it. I should be able to vote directly for the president. It's not democratic when people's votes may not count. I may vote for a president, and he may not win because of the Electoral College. Senator Nelson is not alone in criticizing, obviously, the Electoral College. This is one of about 700 reform efforts there have been, either to reform or, frankly, to eliminate the Electoral College. It's obviously going to be difficult to eliminate the Electoral College because it will take a constitutional amendment. And the founders, very undemocratically, by the way, set the bar pretty high for a constitutional amendment. Two-thirds of both houses of Congress and three-fourths of the state legislatures have to approve a constitutional amendment. So, frankly, the odds that we're going to eliminate the Electoral College via constitutional amendment are very, very slim, particularly some of these smaller states who feel politically advantaged are not likely to line up and vote against it. I would say more likely to succeed is another movement that's a little bit below the radar but picking up rapidly, and that is the National Popular Vote Bill. I don't know if you're familiar with this. It's passed in four states, and it has been proposed in 41 other states, and so it's under very active consideration. The National Popular Vote Bill would, in effect, do an end run around the Electoral College, not eliminate it. It would say that electors are bound to vote for whoever wins, not the popular vote in their own state, by the way, which would have been interesting, but whoever wins the national popular vote. So, in effect, we're going to kind of do away with the Electoral College because whoever wins the national popular vote, all the electors in states that have passed this bill are obligated to then vote for the winner of the national popular vote. Other states' legislatures have passed this, including here in California, though Governor Schwarzenegger is not the only governor, but was one governor who vetoed it, saying that this was really not part of our American traditions. We'll talk about that in a moment. But the question I want to ask with regard to the Republic is, very little discussion in all of this about the original purposes of the Electoral College. It was to be one of the intermediary institutions that helps protect the Republic. Its purpose was to recognize that there's a role for both the people and the states in choosing the president of the United States, and that there should be a place for both small states and large states in the presidential campaign and election process. Does it continue to serve a purpose today? Let me just ask you two questions. What do you think would have happened, what was the likely outcome, if we had not had the Electoral College in the year 2000? That, of course, was the year that Al Gore won in popular votes but lost in the Electoral College. It was also the year in which, of course, we had the lengthy, dramatic recount of Chads and ballots in Florida. So what do you think would have happened if we had not had the Electoral College in 2000? I submit to you that we would have had a national recount in 2000. Florida was not the only state where there were questions about voting and about the legitimacy of ballots. And I suspect in this just-win-baby environment that we have become, with so often little concern about processes and about the Republic, there would have been legal challenges in states all over the country. I don't think we would have chosen a president or seated a president by the January date, and I think America would have been thrust into a great deal of confusion. My point being, you have to aggregate, count ballots somewhere. And it's not a bad idea as a practical matter, in my view, to aggregate them and count them at the state level and not reopen every question, which, by the way, is one of the purposes of the founders creating some of these intermediary institutions of republic, to provide some safety, security, continuity in case of difficulty. Let me ask you, I said two questions. The second question, what do you think a presidential campaign might look like today if we did not have the Electoral College? Well, I think two things would be very different. One is, where would the candidates go? They would go to Los Angeles. They would go to New York. They would go to the great population centers because that's how they would win elections. By contrast, with the Electoral College, where do they go now? Well, in the last couple of weeks of any campaign, you will see people flying literally all over the country, obviously going to Ohio, going to Pennsylvania, going to Florida. In one of the elections, Cheney went to Hawaii because they felt like the Hawaii votes were at question. They go to New Mexico. They go to Colorado. that's the sort of campaign we have. We have people literally moving all over the country because these contests are heated in many parts of the country. So I think we would, instead of that sort of campaign, we would have candidates going to Los Angeles and to New York, primarily to the population centers. The other thing they would do is they would give us an endless barrage of television commercials. I would say, think Super Bowl Sunday, but less entertaining and interesting. It would be a battle of commercials, and it would be a battle of big cities. So again, I'm raising the question, is there some potential practical utility of an electoral college today, or is it entirely outmoded? I think even some practical purpose continues to be served. And I think you could make a very strong case, even though I know people are frustrated with the electoral college, that the state-based election system works very well. That requiring candidates to move around the country and address difficult issues in these battleground states is not an altogether bad thing. That having to go in primaries and in elections to Michigan and talk about jobs that have gone away, to go to Iowa and have to understand ethanol, to go to Arizona and talk about the border, this is kind of what a state-based election system produces. And I submit to you that that has continuing value. But the Electoral College is one of a whole series of these intermediary institutions, as Tocqueville talks about in his book, Democracy in America, that strictly speaking aren't fair and aren't democratic. The U.S. Senate is not democratic. Two senators from every state, no matter what size. The Electoral College is not, strictly speaking, democratic. The Supreme Court is not, strictly speaking, democratic. We don't vote on justices or on their decisions. The bar to amend the Constitution is not, strictly speaking, democratic. But the founders were very aware of the need not just for democracy and fairness, but for the need for stability and the republic to work. And so they created a number of these institutions which would be, in effect, checks and balances, separations of powers that would make the republic work. So that's the second area where I see some danger to the republic, which is, I think a rightly motivated, I'm not questioning the motives here, I think a rightly motivated desire to be as fair and democratic as we can be, but I think we forget, as poor as our civics education is these days, it's not surprising, we forget that we don't live in a democracy, we live in a republic, and that these checks and balances and these separations are part of what makes that system function. So I said I would share with you then three settings. One is from here, our home state of California, and the winds of direct democracy. The second is from this recent election experience, the drive for fairness and greater democracy. And the last one is in what I would call the battle of ideas, where there is a major effort to reform and, in effect, redo the American Constitution as sort of an antiquated, outmoded document. The war of ideas, I think you can sort of write off what professors do in some sense, and many people do that. I work at a think tank, the Hoover Institution at Stanford. People say, well, what do you do in a think tank? I say, well, we sit around and think all day, you know, and occasionally we write things down. But we believe in think tanks that ideas have consequences. And so a lot of the ideas that may just seem like kind of wacky ideas of professors turn out sometimes to then get in legislation or be on ballots or be heard in congressional hearings and have an impact. And I'm noticing, again, in this field, this battle of ideas, an increasing call to fix or redo some of the outmoded elements of the Constitution. About a year ago, a very visible political scientist, Larry Sabato at Virginia, wrote a book called A More Perfect Constitution. The subtitle probably tells more, 23 Ways to Revitalize Our Constitution and Make America a Fairer Country. And this came on the heels about a year before of another influential constitutional scholar, Sanford Levinson, who wrote a book, again the title tells a lot, Our Undemocratic Constitution. And essentially the argument of these professors, and they represent the thinking of a good number of policy and constitutional professors, is that our Constitution is antiquated, it's out of date, it's democratic, it's unfair, and it needs a makeover. We live in an era of, well, if we don't like the way it looks, and we just have a little makeover here. And so we want to take the Constitution into the operating room and see if we can't find 23 ways, as Professor Sabato says, to perfect it and make it a little bit better. So here are some of the ideas that are on the table from these books, particularly from Sabato, since it's more recent. Sabato argues, as I mentioned earlier, that the Senate is not, strictly speaking, democratic and fair, the idea that a small state has as many senators as a large state. And so he suggests that we add a third senator to the larger states. And while we're at it, he thinks the House of Representatives is also too small, and so we ought to grow it, he says, from 435 to an even 1,000. He ignores, obviously, a number of things, in my view, but in particular, I think he ignores, again, this hybrid system we created where the Senate was to represent the interests of states and the House of Representatives was to be the people's house, was to represent people directly. And so the idea is supposed to be that Senators Boxer and Feinstein, for example, represent California in a sense as opposed to representing you and me individually. The presidency, Sabato suggests, we ought to move to a single six-year term. I can't argue too vociferously against that because my mother has been telling me that for about 50 years. But he would add a two-year performance bonus if the president does well, and that gets a little, I think that gets a little bit tricky. He thinks it's very unfair the way we presently decide which primaries go first in the order because that has a disproportionate effect on who gets nominated and who gets elected. So he thinks it would be fairer and more democratic, more perfect, to hold a lottery to decide in which order states will have their primaries. He has a fairly complicated section, which I think I could summarize with reference to hockey, if any of you watch or understand the Sharks or hockey. He believes one of our problems in government is that we don't have enough Republicans or Democrats in office at one time, that we end up constantly in conflict. So he would like to change the election cycle so that, as they do in hockey, they sort of platoon in a bunch of Democrats for a while who can kind of do their thing, and then we have another election and we could platoon in some Republicans who can kind of do their thing instead of having such a mix in there at any given time, which he says leads to conflict. This, I have to say, flies in the face of some very interesting research that suggests that Americans sort of like a split government, if you will, that often Americans deliberately will elect a president of one party but will prefer a Congress of another party. Why is that? Well, there's been, frankly, more speculation than research about why, what the motive would be. One possibility is Americans like the checks and balances. They like government able to do less. I'm from the state of Kansas, and when I was in college, I worked one summer for our state senator, Bob Dole, one of whose nicknames was Senator Gridlock. In fact, he was given an honorary degree at a graduation, and he said, well, at least now they have to call me Dr. Gridlock. But I liked his answer. When asked, you know, he didn't back down from that nickname. When asked why they called him Senator Gridlock, and he said, there are a lot of bad ideas in Washington, and somebody needs to stop them. So he was sort of unapologetic. Well, that's the view that a number of Americans have, is we think there's a lot of bad ideas in Sacramento or Washington or wherever, and so we would like to have people from both parties. And the fact that they don't get anything done isn't altogether a bad thing, because as often as not, they'll do something we don't like as do something we do like. So in any event, Sabato closes by saying, let's don't just amend the Constitution, because again, that's quite difficult, but instead, let's have a new constitutional convention. Let's go back to an earlier day, and let's convene citizens, and let's have a constitutional convention, and let's put these 23 specific ideas on the table. Kind of a scary thought. Where would one find the statesmen and women of a 21st century constitutional convention? Where would you find anyone who could get past the just win, baby, school of politics and have some constituency for the republic, the democracy, and the process? But I guess the common denominator I find in so many of these suggestions is I think these scholars do not recognize we are not a national democracy where our goal is to let the people decide everything. We were intentionally designed as a republic with messy checks and balances, balances of power, and sometimes even gridlock. And I think if we want to make these kind of changes, we at least need to recognize that that is what we would be doing. I mentioned I could have given other examples where I see this in other places. I would talk, if I had more time, about federalism, for example, and the way the federal government is just constantly taking over the role of states, which was part of how a republic was designed to work. Even something so classically local as education, I think, has essentially been federalized by a party which you would have thought maybe had more commitment to federalism than it turned out to have. I would talk about the role of the judiciary. Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers said he expected that the judiciary would be the weakest of the three branches, and that it was intended to be a break against the political branches. Of course, a fair amount of evidence today that, in fact, the judiciary has become a kind of engine, not just a break, has particularly been using the due process and equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment to just decide that something's unfair, something's not democratic, and it can't go forward in our judgment, including, by the way, the recall election that in California that had been, I think, properly noticed and followed, but a panel of the Ninth Circuit said no. Because we're not confident in that your voting is going to be fair, then we're going to stop that recall election, only to have their larger Ninth Circuit then overrule them. So in conclusion, I would remind us, the founders were no great fans of democracy. Alexander Hamilton said, and I quote, "Our real disease is democracy." Benjamin Franklin, typically more colorful, "Democracy is, quote, two wolves and a lamb voting what to have for lunch," unquote. And so they were not great fans of a pure democracy. They very, very deliberately created a complex system of checks and balances and separations of power that we call a republic. We pledge allegiance not to the democracy, if you will, but to the republic. We don't sing the battle hymn of the democracy. We sing the battle hymn of the republic. The Constitution requires every state government be a republic. And so I'm just saying, in our headlong pursuit of other goals, and goals that aren't necessarily bad, democracy and fairness, among others, we must not lose sight of the value and purpose of the republic. We have discovered, and here in the Bay Area, we've discovered it probably more than many, something that's excited a lot of people, hybrid vehicles, vehicles that can run on more than one source of energy. And I submit to you that that's basically what the founders discovered in creating our system of governance. They established a hybrid form of government that runs on the democratic energy of the people, but also relies on the filtering judgment of some of these institutions and programs of republic. And I submit to you that in America, you can find constituencies for almost everything. There's constituencies for the right to bear arms, for renewable energy, even for fairness and democracy. Unfortunately, I don't see a lot of constituency for the republic. And that's what, in my own little way, a few people at a time, I'm at least trying to alert to this danger and opportunity. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to David Davenport, Counselor to the Director for External Relations and Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. I'm Zabre Valentine, Policy Director at California Forward and former Director of the Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform Project, and I will be conducting the audience question portion of this program. Mr. Davenport, we have a number of questions.
I see a lot of cards there, yes.
Yes.
It's all scary.
We have a lot of questions, so let's begin. First, you say that the Founding Fathers aren't fans of democracy. The Founding Fathers also weren't fans of participation by women, slaves, indentured servants, or white men if they didn't own property. Could there have been a link?
You know, there's been quite an historic debate about what the motives of the founders were, and I'm not able to speak really to their motives. There are people who take a high road ground, I suppose, with regard to their motives. There are people who take a lower road ground with respect to their motives. If you take them at their word, what they say more consistently in the Federalist Papers than anything else is a concern with faction and with majority faction in America. And they felt that it was important that a group, even a large group, could not override what they call the cool, deliberate sense of community. So I'll take the high road and say that whatever their personal motive might have been, I think that's, at least that's what they say motivated them.
All right. On to our next question. At the founding of our country, the forefathers never envisioned professional politicians. How does having professional politicians change the dynamic of the republic? Does it hurt or help?
Yeah, and we could add to that question. I also think they didn't contemplate political parties in quite the way we have them today. We had the Federalists and Anti-Federalists, so it's not that they didn't have any political parties, but they certainly don't have what we have today. I think that is problematic and part of the problem. My own view is at the state level, I personally don't favor full-time legislatures, for example, because I would prefer that members of legislatures have to have jobs and live in their districts and spend considerable time there. I think in Washington it would be hard to operate without, obviously, a full-time legislature. So, yes, I think the idea of citizen politician, the role of money, and the role of political parties have all complicated this. And I would say I would assign at least equal blame to the people as well as to the representatives for letting us lose some of what we are losing. That is to say, the poor civic education that we have, the poor levels of civic participation that we have. I'm not one of those who says we have to blame the government for all this, because I think part of the government compact is that we as citizens will be educated, we will become knowledgeable, and we will participate. So, yes, I would say political parties, professional politicians, and money are all present realities that the founders could not have contemplated. Nevertheless, I think there are ample opportunities for citizen engagement and sort of keeping the republic active and alive despite that.
Mm-hmm. So, in your remarks, you focused a lot on the perceived problems with examples of direct democracy. But could you spend a little bit more time just articulating what is so important about a republic as an alternative arrangement, and particularly in a potential future where you have where a much greater portion of the general public than in the day of the Founding Fathers have access to information through the internet, through, you know, better public education and many other things. So you, in theory, I know, don't flinch, but I'm looking toward a brighter future that I know we're going to achieve. When you have a public that's better able to participate in a more sophisticated way.
Yeah, so first of all, I would say that the fact that people have more information doesn't necessarily make them better informed. I mean, as a starting point. As I said, I spent most of my career in education working with college students, and I think the number one skill, if you will, that college students need help in developing is how to find the truth in the midst of, or how to find useful information in the midst of a lot of useless information. I didn't find my college students today better informed and better prepared to be citizens of a republic or democracy than probably they were 50 years ago. So more information, I think, hasn't led to better educated voters and citizens. Why republic over democracy? Well, as I mentioned earlier, the founders' big concern was how people in a democracy could get stirred up in a particular short-term direction, as opposed to what they called the cool and deliberate sense of the community. Now, frankly, as deliberation has eroded in places like Washington and Sacramento, you know, you wonder, well, really, is it that much better? What is the quality of deliberation really like in Washington and Sacramento with all of the polarization and so forth? But at least there is an opportunity, and there are mechanisms there for, as I said, you know, compared to deciding how livestock should be kept by ballot proposition or by elected representatives. They have an opportunity and obligation to listen to expert testimony, to understand the pros and cons of keeping pregnant pigs in one place or another, to amending and saying, okay, well, let's, you know, these pigs can go here. And you and I, by contrast, you know, are asked to read, you know, 100 pages about 12 propositions and walk in and just check yes or no in 5 seconds of time. That kind of deliberation isn't going to happen. So I think the notion of deliberation and longer-term view and better access to information and critiquing information. Those are all things that still elected representatives are in a better position to do than we on a daily basis as people.
Okay. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is David Davenport, research fellow at the Hoover Institution, who is discussing America's founding as a republic rather than a national democracy and the challenges facing that idea in the 21st century. So in California, we have a state legislature that is a representative democracy. So, you know, this looks like a republic, and yet they're still performing abysmally, particularly given the current horrible budget crisis that we're facing. Even when you have a republic, what steps do Americans or do Californians need to be taking so that it can be effective?
Yep. My own view is I think we have a catch-22 in California in which the compact has completely broken down. On the one hand, the citizens have not indicated any real confidence in the legislature. Whenever an important issue comes along, citizens, if they can afford it, are equally likely, if not more likely, to form some kind of special interest group and fund putting a measure on a ballot, as they are to trust it to the legislature to sort that out. As I mentioned earlier, two-thirds of the state budget is tied up either in ballot proposition mandates or federal government mandates. So again, from our citizen side, and you know, term limits, frankly, we don't even trust you enough to leave you there long enough to really learn the system and get good at it. So the citizens in all of those ways are basically saying, we don't trust you really to deal with this stuff. Then the legislators obviously become frustrated, and they say, well, how can we fix a budget when two-thirds of it's already off the table, for example? And how can we address issues when we have these large organized interest groups that we know are going to punish us at the next election? So I think that whole compact has sort of broken down. I don't think there is an easy fix to it. The idea of moderation obviously is part of it, sort of self-restraint. I encourage some of my fellow people on the Republican side of the aisle, for example, that we don't appeal everything. You know, we follow our own principles. We don't appeal everything to courts if we lose something. You know, if we went through a fair process, there needs to be a constituency that just accepts what that process says. I like what John Kerry did and ultimately Al Gore in those two elections, where they said, you know, the republic doesn't need further challenges to these elections. Both of those guys could have challenged those elections further than they did. And again, exercised some restraint, stepped back and said, for the good of the republic, I could press this further, but I'm not going to do that. So I think we need some citizens who are willing to live with the results, even if they don't like them, mm-hmm. And not press everything to the last court decision, the last ballot initiative. I would also, frankly, raise the bar for ballot initiatives. It seems to me it's too easy to get things on the ballot. That would be part of, I think, returning to the original notion that these are to be more extraordinary in their use and in their application. Same with recall. I mean, I think the idea that 12%, you know, you can go out and buy signatures, and if 12% of the people don't like what the governor's doing, then suddenly he's fighting for his electoral life. I think we need to raise that bar. So I think there's some technical things that we can do.
And we have a few cards coming up about the initiative process. Is it possible to just toss it out the window entirely?
Well, I think the progressives would be pretty unhappy with us if we did that. I think if we could, what I would like to see is a return to the notion that these are more extraordinary in nature. And I've already suggested certain tools that maybe you have to have a vote of the legislature to get them on the ballot, or you have to have some much higher percentage of votes. Maybe you need to limit fundraising connected with initiatives. So I would be in favor of sort of dialing them back, not cutting them off completely. What I do personally, I just want you to know, I practice what I preach. I vote against all ballot initiatives on the ground that I don't want to encourage them. Now, I make one or two exceptions from time to time, but I'll tell you one example. I voted for, was it Prop 12 or Prop 11, the redistricting? Yes, I know Zabre would never talk to me again if I didn't vote for that. Why? Because I think that the political leaders are too conflicted and self-interested to set their own rules. And I think it's perfectly legitimate for the people to set the rules of the political game. And I think, frankly, if we don't, we're never going to fix this compact that's broken between the citizens of California and their government. So that's one I voted for, on the ground that the people should set the rules, the politicians are too conflicted to set the rules, and we need some more objective way to do districting. I think if people had greater confidence that there were some contested races, and that if you really didn't like something that was being done, you could replace somebody. I think, again, that is one of the other little pieces that might go to kind of rebuilding that compact.
So we've been focusing on the state of California. We're going to turn for the next few questions to the national stage. What do you think about the extensions of presidential power over the last 8 years? Aren't those extensions problematic for the preservation of our republic?
I think by and large they are. I'll just take, for example, the presidential signing statements. I see no basis in the Constitution for the president saying, yes, I'm signing this, but what I really mean is, or what I really intend is. Now, having said that, I don't think it undoes the republic, because I think basically they've been ignored. And I don't see how they would have any force and effect in a court of law, for example. Because, I mean, there's just no constitutional basis for the president signing and saying, but I really meant this when I signed it. So I think they are problematic. I just don't think, at least in that case, they're going to have any real practical effect.
Okay. Do you take any solace in the high voter turnout for Barack Obama? In the sense of it potentially being an indication of a renewed interest in political activism?
Yes, I do. And as I said, my primary working life has been with college students who, and it's, everything you read about it is true. They are increasingly disillusioned with political and governance solutions. The good news is they're much more interested in community service and doing things sort of locally and within their own realm. So it's not that they've become inactive. They just have given up to a large degree on the political governance processes. I have exposure to a scholar at Stanford, Bill Damon, who does studies of adolescence, and he's following a pool of 400 adolescents over a period of time. And he said, here's one discouraging data point. He said of his 440 in his database, only four, less than 1%, indicated any interest in civic leadership in the future, in being a mayor, a city council person, president of the United States. And he said, unfortunately, when they did the polling again this year, one of the four dropped out. So now it's, you know, precipitously low. But so, yes, I guess what I want to say first is I think this discouragement about young people in the political process is real. I think the fact that they connected with Obama was also real. Again, I can give you an anecdote that may be somewhat instructive. I have a Republican colleague. There are a couple at Stanford. I have a Republican colleague at Stanford who said normally when he goes to vote, he can go in at 10 o'clock in the morning and there's nobody there, and he just breezes right through. He went in this time. He said that he had to there were 300 or 400 people in line. He said, now, fortunately, he went to the party line that was shorter, so he still got out quickly. But he just said, you know, that's real. Those are 300 or 400 people that have never been there before in a Stanford polling area. Now, the question is, can that be sustained beyond voting? Because the kinds of problems we're talking about require citizen engagement and involvement beyond voting, in between voting. And whether that can be converted or not, I mean, I think President Obama has a chance to model that. I don't think he can fix that. But yes, I think I take encouragement from the voter turnout.
Talk a little bit more about civic engagement, if you would, if the kind that you're describing. What are reasonable expectations to drive toward for people who are involved in increasing channels and strengthening opportunities for civic engagement, as well as for individuals who are looking to get more involved?
I think part of the problem today is the founders assumed a level of civic engagement that existed at that time, which we can no longer assume. The New England town meeting is now considered as anachronistic, as I guess the Constitution by some. We don't have that kind of civic engagement. And so what I mean by civic engagement is finding opportunities for citizens to be engaged in self-governance, primarily, I would assume, at the local level, just because it's much more difficult to do on the statewide level. And as you know, Zabre, I'm involved in a group, Common Sense California, that has discovered some new tools of citizen engagement, deliberative polling, 21st century town hall meetings that use technology as well as face-to-face meetings, in a sense focus groups or choice kind of groups, where people can come together, and I think they're particularly effective at the local regional level, and work on some of the hard issues together. What government officials say is, I think, frustrating and true. What they say is, when they have to make a decision, the only citizens they ever hear from are people who have a particular interest in that issue. They have a vested interest in how that issue goes. If it's a real estate development project, they hear from the developers and they hear from environmental groups who want to stop it. And they said, what we'd like to hear is, what do regular citizens, what kind of vision do they have for this city, and does it incorporate some of this kind of development or not? We can't hear from those people. So I think we're going to have to be more deliberate in how we engage citizens. I don't think these town hall meetings will just happen today. And so if I may give a bipartisan plug, because it's a bipartisan website, to go to commonsenseca.org. You can see there we are now doing projects all over the state in which we are using these tools of citizen engagement to try to get ordinary citizens involved. So that's the sort of thing I'm talking about, is to take enough interest to get involved in your school district or in a park district or in some of the tough budget questions that are facing cities today in California and beyond. Something beyond just voting, although obviously voting is crucial.
So I'm going to keep you on civic engagement for one more question here, and focus specifically on younger voters. So let's say, you know, under 35s or under 30s. And the question here says that, you know, it seems that we have a chicken or the egg problem, that young people are disillusioned because the system seems to work so terribly, so poorly. But in order for the system to work better, those same young people need to get involved in it to turn it around. How do you get that going?
Well, it is a vicious cycle. And as an educator, obviously, I think that education is part of the solution. I mean, I think our level of civic education at this point is just abysmal. And there are ways now that didn't exist before to engage students and young people in civic engagement opportunities directly that are not just going to a class and listening to a lecture on civics. To be candid with you, I've got three kids in their 20s. If I said I was talking about the republic versus the democracy, even in my own kids, I think I would get blank, you know, stares, because it's just not something that, you know, that kids have learned about and been engaged in. So in my view, we could take advantage of younger people's interest in service learning and in community service, and it's not that far a bridge over into school districts and park districts and library districts and cities where governance is involved. And so I think that would be one promising thing, is to take the young people's interest in service, community service, and build bridges then into governance questions. I also think, again, with some of these tools, I'm working with someone on the possibility of a citizens' assembly, if you will, of young people to come and debate and deliberate some of these issues. And, you know, probably some media coverage would result and so forth. So it's going to take some time, but those would be some thoughts I have.
Okay, great. You said when you were wrapping up your remarks that if you had more time, you would talk about federalism. We have a question here that asks, if we were to think about states' rights versus federalism, how does that mesh with your view of the importance of a republic?
Well, the idea that, I mean, I have just spent 5 years teaching in a school of public policy at Pepperdine, and the number one thing I tried to teach students was this. If you have a question or a concern, first ask yourself, is this for individuals or for communities or for governments to decide? Typically in a school of public policy, they look at a policy question and they study a government solution. Well, some questions are not best answered by government. So to me, that's question number one. Then question number two, in terms of sort of civic understanding, is if it is a government question, what level of government ought to be addressing that? Federal, state, local? And within that, which branch of that government? Executive, legislative, judiciary. And so anytime you – and that's part of this complex system of republic that I described, where the founders attempted to assign different responsibilities to different branches with an understanding that they could check and balance one another and that a division of power is better than putting all that power in one place. So, for example, when the federal government largely federalizes education, or at least takes very strong initiatives to federalize education, then we start disarming the states and the local areas. And rather than state and local areas deciding what they want to have taught in classrooms, they have to instead teach what the federal government's going to reward with federal grant money. And so, in effect, we have removed the involvement of local people in setting those educational goals, and we've transferred that power, in effect, to Washington. That would just be one, you know, of many examples. So the minute you take things that probably should be local and you move it to Washington, D.C., you have begun to weaken one of the strong checks and balances and separations of power. You've probably taken the power away from people who are closest to it and best understand its uses. And so in that way, I think it does undercut the republic. I mean, I think teachers and superintendents would tell you that if they were able to say more about how education is done in their classroom, a better job could be done than having somebody decide in Washington that instead they need to be teaching so you can pass this test. I mean.
And what is the impact or relevance of these current times that we're in with the economic meltdown, the security challenges that we have today? What kind of pressures do they bring to bear?
Well, I think it's going to increase federal power in Washington and decrease local and state power. Now, this gets into an extensive historic debate. But obviously, the Republic faced this crisis in the Depression New Deal era. And if you've read the historical debates, the understanding was that in those kind of emergency exigent circumstances, the federal government would need to play a larger role. And so significant transfer of power was done at that time. In terms of the viability of federalism and the Republic, most of that was never undone. And so the emergency became a regular way of doing business. And that, I think, is the difficult republic question we face now. I think a very strong case can be made. Here you have a Republican President Bush and a Democratic President Obama who both agree Washington has to take aggressive action here. And the question is that going to become now a regularized way of doing business? Are we going to have regular bailouts? Or is this going to be an emergency measure and we are then going to return power to states? I'll mention one other thing that I find somewhat encouraging, and that is a lot of states with strong governors are pushing back on Washington, including our own governor here, who, you know, if you just a couple of three quick data points, who showed up at the United Nations, you know, talking about California as a nation state, and who said that, you know, Washington wasn't doing enough about, you know, air quality, and so we were going to be more aggressive about that. And Washington wasn't doing enough about climate change, and because California has special problems that Kansas doesn't have, California should get to do some extra things about that that Kansas might not choose to do. So I basically take that as a good sign that we have some states who are kind of stepping up and saying, you know, all 50 states don't have to look the same. Oregon doesn't have to have the same medical marijuana policy as Kansas. California doesn't have to have the same climate, you know, control policy as Illinois. So there are some good signs, but I think in these overwhelming times of sort of economic and national security crisis, Washington naturally and probably rightly plays a larger role. I think what's unfortunate is then it's hard to kind of go back to business as usual, and I think the New Deal sort of taught us that.
Unfortunately, there's time for only one more question. And we've got a question here that says, do you believe the two-party system is in jeopardy today? And what is the future of the Republican Party? Just as a quick final question wrap up.
The two-party system in California has been in jeopardy almost the whole time, the 20 or 30 years I've lived here, and I think it's in more jeopardy. I don't think it's in any kind of permanent jeopardy, no. I mean, I think I have the pendular view of history. It sort of swings one way, and then it gets kind of far out there, and those people mess it up, and then it sort of swings back the other way. So I suspect the Republican Party will go through a bit of a wilderness, but will either discover some leaders or some ideas that will empower it again.
Our thanks to David Davenport, counselor of the and Director for External Relations and Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. Tonight's program has been part of the club's Toby American Values series, underwritten by the Toby Family Foundation. I'm Zabre Valentine, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.